Welcome to our deep dive into the hidden geometry of ice hockey. Today, we are taking a really masterclass approach to our source material, and the mission is straightforward, but, you know, incredibly ambitious.
Yeah, we're basically going to try and completely rewire how you watch, how you play, and, well, how you mentally process the sport of hockey.
Exactly. Because when you're first taught a team sport, or even when you just sit down to watch one as a casual fan, there is usually this comforting illusion of order. Like, think of a coach's whiteboard hanging up in the locker room, right?
Yeah, the classic whiteboard.
You have these static X's and O's neatly arranged in a formation. The center is told to stand exactly here. The left winger gets a dot on the left side. The right defenseman gets a dot back by the blue line. It feels like a map.
Right. You get a job, you get a coordinate, and you just go stand on your dot, trusting that if everyone stands on their dot, the whole system works.
But it gives a beginner, and honestly, even a lot of intermediate players, a false sense of security, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You learn your role by learning your assigned place on the ice. But the second the puck drops, I mean, the reality of the game just shatters that whiteboard instantly.
Yeah, you graduate from beginner hockey or you turn on your TV to watch an elite professional game and that whiteboard model is totally useless. I mean, the game is moving at 30 miles an hour. Players are constantly swapping sides.
Defensemen are pinching deep into the offensive zone.
Right. Forwards are covering the point. Those neat little static formations are completely unrecognizable within, like, 3 seconds of a shift starting.
Yeah, and to the untrained eye, it can just look like sheer chaos, 10 skaters flying around randomly.
But the core thesis of our source material today is that what we are looking at is not chaos at all. It is a highly fluid, invisible geometry.
And understanding the geometry requires unlearning the whiteboard entirely. The idea that your position is a fixed spot on the ice is, well, it's a conceptual trap.
A huge trap.
Right. It is a fundamental misunderstanding of the sport that secretly costs teams games every single weekend at every level, you know, from amateur all the way to professional.
So your correct position on the ice is never a fixed geographical coordinate.
Never. Instead, your position is a fluid set of relationships. It is defined entirely by your distance and your angle relative to two moving variables,
which are the puck and your teammates.
Exactly. Hockey is not a game of fixed spots. It is a game of dynamic spacing.
Okay, so we're setting up a major premise here, which is spacing beats skill. And I really want to unpack this thoroughly because it feels a bit counterintuitive to, you know, everything we are sold about the sport.
Yeah, it goes against the highlight reel culture for sure.
Right. When we watch highlight reels, we worship individual skill. We see the incredible one-on-one dangling, the between the legs toe drags, the sheer individual brilliance of a star player beating three defenders by themselves.
And we are conditioned to think that the team with the most dazzling skill wins. But the math in our sources tells a completely different story.
So let's talk about that math, because the math is unforgiving.
It really is. Yeah. It exposes why relying on individual skill is a terrible long-term strategy. Let's break down the reality of a puck carrier under pressure.
Okay, paint the picture for us.
So in a live game, a player who receives the puck has to make a critical decision in well under a single second. And the success of that decision is not actually determined by their stick handling ability.
Wait, really? It's not about how good their hands are?
Not primarily, no. It is completely capped by the number of viable passing options their teammates are providing in that specific fraction of a second.
Okay, so let's categorize this into three distinct scenarios, like the sources do. First, let's analyze the zero option scenario.
Right. If your teammates are covered or out of position or just standing still and they give you zero passing options, you are forced into a one-on-one duel with a defender. You are required to physically beat them by yourself just to keep possession.
And if we look at the statistics of those one-on-one duels, I mean, even if you are an elite generational talent, you are going to lose that confrontation a significant percentage of the time, right?
Absolutely. The modern defense is simply too fast, too structured, and too big.
So if a team's lack of spacing constantly forces their puck carriers into zero option situations, they are mathematically guaranteeing a high turnover rate.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So let's escalate to the one option scenario. You have the puck, the pressure is closing in, and exactly one teammate works hard to make themselves available.
Is that enough?
The structural answer is no. A single passing option is easily neutralized by a single competent defender.
Because a good checker doesn't even need to touch the puck, do they?
No, they don't. Mm-hmm. They just physically maneuver their body or their stick blade into that single passing lane. Instantly, your one option is erased, and you are right back in the zero option scenario.
Forced into a desperate individual duel.
Right. Which brings us to the core arithmetic of the game. Two options.
But the source material puts a massive asterisk next to this, which I found fascinating. It is not just about having two options. They must be at different angles.
Yes. Let's explore the physical reality of why the angle matters so much. Consider the geometry of a defender's reach.
Okay, so if I offer a puck carrier two options, but both of those teammates are standing in roughly the same direction, what happens?
Well, say both are up the ice along the same wall. A single defender can still block both passes with one positioning choice.
Because their body or their stick blade intersects the line of sight for both options.
Exactly. But if you provide two options at different angles, say one straight up the ice and one lateral across the ice, the physical dynamics change.
A single defender physically cannot cover both divergent lanes simultaneously. I mean, they cannot stretch 10 feet wide.
Right. They are forced to make a choice to cover one, which inherently leaves the other wide open.
And this triggers a really fascinating chain reaction. If that single defender chooses option A, option B is open. But if the opposing team realizes this and sends a second defender over to help cover option B, what happens to the overall balance of the ice?
The math tilts entirely in your favor. I mean, there are only five defending skaters. If two of them are now occupied trying to solve your two divergent passing angles, a third option opens up somewhere else on the rink.
The defense is constantly chasing a mathematical deficit. That is brilliant. Let's pause and anchor this concept for you, the listener, because it is the foundation for everything we are going to discuss today.
Yeah, this is the big takeaway. What does this arithmetic mean for you practically on the ice?
It means that a team of average, you know, just fundamentally sound players who consistently provide two constant passing options at different angles will entirely dominate a team of highly skilled, highlight reel players who offer none.
Because the average team uses spacing to put the puck carrier in a situation the defense mathematically cannot solve by individual effort alone.
Exactly. The skilled team, by lacking support, asks every single puck carrier to win a desperate duel every time they touch the puck. Spacing is not just some nice theoretical footnote to skill. It is the absolute driver of possession.
So since two options at different angles is the non-negotiable magic number, the imperative question becomes, well, how do we physically arrange ourselves on the ice to guarantee we always provide them?
Right. How do we make that happen? To answer this, we have to understand the fundamental shape of hockey. We have to look at lines versus triangles, and specifically, why we desperately want to avoid ever standing in a straight line.
Let's paint a vivid picture here. Imagine the attacking half of the rink. You have three teammates positioned along the right side boards.
Okay, so let's say one player is battling deep in the corner with the puck, a second player is halfway up the boards at the hash marks, and a third player is even higher up near the blue line.
Right. Now, to a beginner, this might look organized. They're spaced out. They are in their quote-unquote lane.
But strategically, it is the absolute worst shape you can form. I like the analogy used in the sources. I like to think of it as meat on a skewer.
The skewer analogy perfectly illustrates the structural flaw. When you string three players in a straight line, one single defensive stick blade placed accurately in that single lane comes two passing options at once.
The defender doesn't need to work hard at all. They just stand between the puck carrier in the corner and the other two players up the wall.
Exactly. The line is the absolute cheapest shape in hockey to defend. You are allowing one opponent to guard three of your players.
So, our meat on a skewer is failing miserably. The puck carrier is trapped. How do we mechanically fix it? We take one of those three players, let's say the middle one at the hash marks, and we pull them off the straight line.
Yes, you drag them toward the center of the ice into the slot.
And instantly, the shape transforms. It is no longer a line, it is a triangle.
And by dragging that player into the middle, you profoundly alter the physics of the passing lanes.
Because the passing lanes now diverge from the puck carrier. One lane goes straight up the wall to the point, and the second lane cuts diagonally into the middle of the ice.
Right. So if the defender stays near the boards to block the pass up the wall, they have to physically turn their body and their stick away from the player in the middle.
No single defender can stretch to be in both lanes simultaneously. You have solved the one defender problem.
Exactly.
But I want to challenge this structurally, though, because this is where my intuition as a player gets a bit tripped up.
Okay, let's hear it.
We do the work. We form this beautiful triangle. It successfully gives the carrier two options at different angles. Then the puck carrier makes the brilliant pass to the player who moved into the middle of the ice. Doesn't the triangle just instantly break the second that pass is completed?
That's a great question.
Right, because now the puck is in the middle, the shape is skewed, and it feels like we have to scramble in a panic to set up a brand new triangle before the defense closes in.
That is the assumption most players make. But the reality of the geometry proves otherwise. This is exactly the genius of the triangle and why it is the foundational shape of the game, rather than, say, a square or a pentagon.
Oh, okay. How so?
A straight line must be completely rebuilt from scratch after a pass. But a triangle is the absolute smallest polygon, where all three corners naturally provide two teammates at different angles.
So you're saying it is mathematically resilient from every single point?
Precisely. Whichever of the three players ends up with the puck, the support requirement of two options at different angles is already perfectly satisfied.
Wow, okay.
When the puck moves from the player in the corner to the player in the middle, you do not have to sprint to rebuild the shape. The player who just received the puck instantly has the player in the corner as one option and the player at the point as the second option.
The triangle simply rotates, stretches, and tilts across the ice as the puck travels, but the structural connection remains intact. It is a shape you maintain in motion, not a rigid formation you set up and dismantle.
That is exactly the point.
Let's do a quick retrieval check for the listener to cement this in our minds. What is the key takeaway about the triangle here?
The key takeaway is that a triangle is a minimum requirement, not a maximum limit.
Right, because when you are out there, you have five skaters on the ice. You aren't just building one isolated three-person triangle while two players stand around watching.
No, you are constantly building overlapping dynamic triangles. In practical application, three players form the immediate, tight support triangle around the puck to guarantee possession.
And then what about the other two?
A fourth player is typically positioned wider on the far side of the ice to stretch the defense, and a fifth player sits higher up the ice as a structural safety. But that core three-man triangle closest to the puck is the engine that drives every single successful play.
All right, so we understand our foundational shape. We know we absolutely need a triangle to force the passing lanes to diverge and render a single defender useless. But knowing to form a triangle is only step one.
Right. Shape alone isn't enough.
The immediate next question is about the physics of support. Like, how large should this triangle be? Because if you understand the shape but stand in the completely wrong place, you aren't actually supporting the puck carrier. You are just being expensive on ice decoration.
The physical distance between the players and the triangle is everything. Support has a highly specific mathematical working range, and if you operate outside of it in either extreme, you are actively sabotaging your own team's possession.
Let's analyze the extreme errors first. What structurally happens when a supporting player gets too close to the puck carrier?
Well, this is an incredibly common trap, particularly with beginners or just, you know, incredibly earnest players who want to help their teammate out.
Yeah, let's say you see your defenseman struggling with a bouncing puck behind your own net, and an opposing forechecker is bearing down on them fast. Your human instinct is to rush right over to them to be a good teammate. You skate hard and stop just 2 or 3 feet away from them.
It is an understandable instinct, but a disastrous tactical decision.
Why is that?
If you skate inside the physical stick reach of the opposing checker who is pressuring your teammate, you have just handed the defense a massive, unearned gift.
Oh, because that one forechecker suddenly gets a 2-for-1 deal.
Exactly. With one body position and one sweep of their stick, they are now effectively guarding both you and your teammate. By moving too close, you have allowed one opponent to eliminate two offensive players. You have essentially given the other team a free man somewhere else on the ice.
Not only do you give the defense a free man, but you actively sabotage the player you are trying to help. Because a puck carrier who is fighting off pressure desperately needs a pocket of open ice to spin into, to shield the puck, or to escape.
Right. And if you skate to within 3 feet of them, you are standing right in their escape route. You have shrunk their available world down to a phone booth.
And let's say they perform a miracle and actually execute a pass to you from 2 feet away. What is the result?
You instantly inherit the exact same suffocating pressure. The forechecker who was crushing them doesn't even have to take a stride. They just pivot. And now they are crushing you before you can even settle the puck on your blade.
You just moved the emergency 2 feet to the left. You did not solve it.
Exactly. So suffocating your teammate by being too close is fatal to possession. Now let's explore the opposite extreme. What happens when you try to support by being too far away? Imagine you establish your point of the triangle 40 or 50 feet directly across the ice.
I think the allure here is the highlight reel factor, right? A 50-foot cross-ice saucer pass feels heroic. It looks amazing on television.
It does, but the physics of a long pass make it incredibly fragile. A puck traveling 50 feet across the ice simply takes too much time to reach its destination.
And during that travel time, every single defender on the ice has the opportunity to read the play, adjust their skating angle, and extend a stick into the lane to intercept it.
The exposure time is a massive liability. Furthermore, to make a pass travel 50 feet without being intercepted, the passer has to fire it incredibly hard.
Right. A long pass arrives at a high velocity. It is frequently bouncing by the time it reaches you, and you're trying to corral it, while a defender, who had a full second to read the play, is already closing the gap to hit you.
Yeah, but the most insidious and damaging consequence of being too far away actually reveals itself after the pass is completed.
Right, because the geometry doesn't stop. Support does not end the moment the puck leaves your teammate's stick.
Exactly. The player who just executed that 50-foot pass to you is now completely out of the play. When you receive the puck, you immediately need your two passing options.
Yeah.
But because your teammate is 50 feet away, they are vastly too far away to help you with the next sequence.
You are isolated on an island. You have the puck, but you have no immediate support.
So we have clearly ruled out the extremes. Too close brings the checker to the puck, too far exposes the pass, and isolates the receiver.
This logically leads us to the Goldilocks zone. Where exactly should we be standing to make this geometric engine work properly?
The standard coaching baseline for support distance is roughly 10 to 15 feet, which translates physically to about 2 to 3 stick lengths.
That's a great measurement you can quickly visualize on the ice. A standard senior hockey stick is about 1.5 meters, or roughly 5 feet long. 2 to 3 of those laid end to end is your ideal working range.
It strikes the perfect physical balance. It is close enough that a pass takes less than half a second to complete, meaning defenders cannot react in time to intercept it, but it is far enough away that a single defender cannot physically reach both of you with one lunge.
The source material brings in a fantastic, nuanced quote from Larry Bruguière, a former USA Hockey Pacific District coach-in-chief, regarding this exact distance. He emphasizes small area possession, and he actually tightens that ideal range even further.
Right, he says, generally the 40-foot pass isn't a good option. The 8 to 10-foot or less pass is really what the small area games are all about.
Bruguière's insight is vital because it introduces the variable of defensive pressure. Context dictates the exact measurement, right?
Yes. When the puck carrier is under heavy, aggressive pressure in a corner, that 8 to 10-foot range is superior. The pass must be instantaneous, almost a handoff, to beat the immediate checker.
Conversely, when the puck carrier has open ice and time, you can stretch that support distance out to the full 15 feet. Stretching the triangle forces the defense to cover more square footage, creating larger gaps in their structure.
Exactly.
This naturally leads to a really practical structural question. How does the physical size of the ice rink fundamentally change this math? We talk about 10 to 15 feet, but not every sheet of ice in the world is the same size.
That is a critical variable that players must adapt to. The standard National Hockey League rink is 85 feet wide. Everything in the NHL is calibrated to that specific width.
But if you step onto an international ice surface governed by the IIHF, like at the Olympics or a World Championship, those rinks can be up to 30 meters wide, which is roughly 98 feet. That is an extra 13 feet of open ice to cross.
Right. So how does that extra 13 feet alter the geometry of the triangle? Well, if you maintain a strict 10-foot support distance on a 98-foot wide rink, you are going to leave massive, glaring acres of unused ice on the far side of the rink.
The defense can simply compress around your tight triangle and ignore a third of the rink.
Yes. On wider ice, your support distances have to scale up proportionately to force the defense to defend the full width. A 15-foot pass becomes more standard.
However, you must always check the specific rink dimensions before a game, because while the IIHF maximum is 30 meters, their minimum is 26 meters, which is essentially the NHL width. You can't just assume an international rink is wide.
Exactly. And if we look at the United Kingdom, it gets even more unpredictable. The UK in-house rules frequently authorize non-standard playing surfaces that are significantly below the 56 by 26 meter minimums for almost all amateur levels.
So when you step onto a smaller, non-standard UK rink, the time and space available vanish. The geometry must instantly adapt to the smaller container.
Your support distances have to shrink back down to Bruyere's 8 to 10 foot range, because a 15 foot pass on a tiny rink might inadvertently put you right into the lap of a secondary defender.
The fundamental rule remains, though. The distances scale up or down with the size of the rink, but the angles never change. The divergent triangle must be maintained regardless of the square footage.
Absolutely.
I want to share the ultimate self-test provided in the source material because I think it's brilliant. As a player, trying to mentally calculate if you are 10 feet or 13 feet away while you are stating backwards, tracking a puck, and avoiding a defenseman is completely impossible.
It is, yeah.
So the sources suggest we stop measuring distance in feet and start measuring it in time. The self-test is one simple question. If my teammate released the puck right this exact second, would it reach my stick before the closest defender gets to me?
It is the perfect heuristic. If the honest answer is yes, the puck will beat the man, then you are positioned perfectly in the Goldilocks zone.
But if the answer is no, the defender will hit me or intercept it before it arrives, then you are too far away and you are just decorating the ice.
Precisely.
Let's transition and go deeper. We have established that the shape must be a triangle. We have defined the distance using the time test, roughly 2 to 3 stick lengths, but distance is only half the equation.
Distance tells you how far away to stand, but angle tells you what kind of option you are physically providing to the puck carrier.
To make the physics of the triangle functional, there are 3 specific 3D angles we need to deconstruct: support behind the puck, support level with the puck, and support ahead of the puck.
Let's systematically analyze each one, starting with support behind the puck. This is universally known as your outlet. Geographically, you are standing in the space between the puck carrier and your own net, meaning you are further back down the ice than the puck.
From a strategic standpoint, why is this specific angle an absolute non-negotiable?
Because it provides a guaranteed, low-risk reset mechanism.
Yeah.
Think about the flow of momentum in hockey. The defending team is forechecking, meaning they are aggressively skating forward, trying to compress the play toward your net.
So when you pass backward to the outlet, you are passing the puck into the empty space that the opposition has just vacated. The ice behind the puck is mathematically the least contested area on the entire rink.
Exactly. This is your ultimate safety valve. If the passing options level with the puck and ahead of the puck are smothered by great defense, the outlet behind the puck must be there to save the possession.
If a team systematically fails to provide an outlet, like if no one drops behind the puck, what is the inevitable result when the pressure hits?
The puck carrier gets swarmed, panics, and is forced to blindly chip or dump the puck away.
And as the source notes articulate beautifully, dumping the puck when you aren't changing lines is just a turnover that you voluntarily chose to make.
Exactly right. You surrendered the puck simply because you lacked geometric support.
So who typically provides this outlet?
Given the flow of play, it is usually the lowest player on the ice relative to your own net, typically a defenseman or a center who is supporting deep in their own defensive zone. And crucially, providing the outlet requires loud verbal communication.
The standard cue across all levels of hockey is to yell back to let the carrier know they have a guaranteed escape route, right?
Right. So we have secured the option behind the puck. The second angle is support level with the puck. This is your lateral option. Geographically, you are approximately the same distance from your own net as the puck carrier, but you are physically stationed across from them on the width of the ice.
What is the tactical purpose of the lateral option?
The lateral option is designed to rapidly change the side of the ice. Defense is fundamentally about compressing space. Defensive pressure is almost always intensely concentrated on the strong side, the half of the ice where the puck currently resides.
The defending team overloads that side to trap the carrier. By offering a lateral option, you provide the carrier a mechanism to instantly transport the puck to the weak side, which is the half of the ice where defensive coverage is thinnest or non-existent.
Exactly. A rapid lateral pass forces the entire defensive structure to suddenly stop their forward momentum, turn their hips, and desperately scramble to reset their positioning on the opposite side of the rink.
But there is a massive flashing red warning sign attached to the lateral option, particularly depending on where you are on the ice. We need to make this rule explicitly clear.
Yes. It is perhaps the most dangerous mistake a player can make. A lateral pass, by its very geometric definition, crosses the width of the ice in front of people.
When you are in the neutral zone or attacking in the offensive zone, passing laterally across the face of the defense is a high-value, highly effective play that stretches coverage.
However, when you are in your own defensive zone, you must absolutely never attempt a lateral pass directly across the middle of the ice.
But put it bluntly, never, ever pass through the slot in your own end.
The math of risk versus reward completely breaks down there. A lateral pass across the middle in your own defensive zone crosses directly through the slot, the prime scoring area, right in front of your own goaltender.
If a defender anticipates that pass and intercepts it, it is not just a standard turnover. It instantly becomes a point-blank, high-danger scoring chance for an opponent who is already directly facing your goaltender from 15 feet away.
If you need to utilize a lateral option to change sides in your own end, that pass must be routed safely behind your own net, using the boards as a buffer, never exposed through the slot.
Okay, we have covered the safety of behind and the side-to-side stretch of level. The final geometric angle is support ahead of the puck. This is the attacking option. You are positioned further up the ice, closer to the opponent's net than the puck carrier.
This is the high-reward, high-risk option. It is the only angle of the three that actively gains geographical territory. And gaining territory is the prerequisite for scoring goals.
But this territory comes at a severe cost.
It does. A pass pushed ahead of the puck is mathematically the most easily intercepted by defenders because they are already positioned between the puck and their own net, usually retreating backward while facing the play. They can see the pass coming the entire way.
Furthermore, if that forward pass is intercepted, the player who skated ahead to be the option is now caught stranded deep in the offensive zone behind the play and is completely useless to help defend the resulting counterattack.
We also have to do a deep dive into the rulebook here because the ahead option is totally governed by the offside constraint. The physical reality of how a player supports ahead of the puck changes dramatically depending on which governing body's rulebook you are playing under.
Oh, this is a great point. If you are a forward stretching ahead to receive a pass as you enter the offensive zone, you have to stay onside at the blue line.
The foundational rule of offside is universal. The puck must completely cross the leading edge of the blue line before both of the attacking player's skates cross it. If you have one skate touching the blue line or in the neutral zone, but your other skate is over the line, you are considered onside.
But the critical difference, the detail that fundamentally alters the timing of a rush, lies in whether that trailing skate must physically touch the ice surface.
Right. This is where it gets incredibly technical, but vastly important. Imagine a forward stretching out to catch a hard pass. Their front skate is deep in the offensive zone. Their back skate, their trail skate, is hovering 6 inches in the air directly above the blue line. Are they offside?
Well, if you are watching the NHL or playing in an IIHF-sanctioned international tournament, a raised trail skate is perfectly legal and considered onside. The governing logic is that the blue line is a three-dimensional vertical plane that extends upward from the ice.
As long as your skate breaks that vertical plane, even in midair, you are legal. This allows NHL players to enter the zone with explosive, unimpeded forward momentum, practically leaning their entire upper body into the zone to catch a pass.
But if you are playing amateur hockey in North America under USA Hockey or Hockey Canada rules, that exact same play, the skate hovering in the air over the blue line, is blown dead as offside.
Exactly. USA Hockey and Hockey Canada explicitly require physical, tactile skate contact with the ice surface. The plane does not extend vertically for the skate. You must have a blade physically touching the blue line or the neutral zone ice until the puck crosses.
So why does this matter for the geometry of support? It entirely changes the physics of the entry. If a USA hockey player is stretching for a pass, they cannot just lean forward and hover their foot. They have to physically anchor their trailing blade into the ice to maintain contact.
Dragging a blade creates friction. It structurally slows down their momentum. It means the puck carrier providing the pass has to adjust their timing, leading the receiver slightly less than they would in an NHL game because the receiver is mechanically anchored to the blue line. It shrinks the margin for error on the attacking angle.
To synthesize this module, why are we meticulously defining these three angles, behind, level, and ahead? Because a functionally dominant hockey team requires all three of these options to be available simultaneously across the ice.
That right there is the working definition of effective spacing. Here's where it gets truly transformative for your mindset as a player.
Yeah.
When you are on the ice, you see your teammate secure the puck, and your brain tells you to skate somewhere to support them. The worst question you can ask yourself in that moment is, am I open?
Right, because asking, am I open, implies you are just looking for empty ice, regardless of its strategic value. Instead, you must analyze the geometry of the immediate play and ask, which of the three angles is currently missing?
Exactly. Look at your teammates. If your center is already dropping behind the play to provide the safe outlet, and your other winger is already stretching ahead to attack the blue line, you do not need to join them.
You need to read the missing piece, slide across the ice, and become the lateral option.
Right. If all the support is rushing ahead, there is no reset valve. If all the support drops behind, the attack dies. You must diagnose the missing angle and consciously choose to become that angle.
It changes everything about how you read the flow of the ice. Let's transition and take these theoretical angles and map them onto the physical geography of the rink. We are talking about the counterintuitive rules of space.
Yeah, we just used the relational terms behind, level, and ahead. But when you are in a locker room, coaches will almost exclusively use the geographical terms above, level, and below the puck. We need to clearly define this terminology because it dictates defensive responsibility.
This is the vocabulary that governs every back-checking system in the sport. The term above, always, without exception, means you are positioned goal side of the puck, relative to the specific net your team is defending.
It is completely independent of which zone you are in. If you are standing physically between the puck and your own goaltender, you are considered above the puck. Conversely, below means the puck is between you and your own net.
So to clarify, a forward who is battling deep in the offensive zone corner, trying to score, is actually positioned below the puck if the puck gets passed back to their own defenseman waiting at the blue line.
Precisely. And understanding this geographic relationship is vital because the fundamental safety convention of hockey. The non-negotiable rule is that somebody, at least one player, must always stay above a puck in every single zone at all times.
That player is deliberately sacrificing their involvement in the immediate offensive attack. They are the structural insurance policy designed to prevent an offensive turnover from instantly becoming a disastrous odd man counter rush the other way.
Unless a coach explicitly calls a desperate tactical play, like pulling the goalie for an extra attacker in the final minute or reacting to a delayed penalty, someone must maintain that safety position above the puck.
And let's do a quick clarification on roles, because coaches often yell about F1, F2, and F3. Those are not fixed identities. The player playing center is not permanently F1.
No, F1 simply designates whoever arrives at the puck first. F2 is the second player to arrive. It is a chronological order of arrival, not a permanent job title printed on a jersey.
Now that we understand the geographic map of above, level, and below, we need to examine how amateur players completely ruin this special integrity. This brings us to what the source text identifies as perhaps the single most common destructive habit that separates beginner from intermediate hockey, the puck magnet problem.
Oh, the analogy for this is painfully accurate. Picture a Saturday morning youth soccer game with six-year-olds. They don't understand positions or spacing. They just form this giant, chaotic, swirling clump of 10 little bodies that magnetically follows the ball wherever it slowly rolls around the grass.
Wherever the ball goes, the clump goes.
It is a humorous image in youth soccer, but adult amateur hockey players replicate this exact behavior constantly. The puck gets chipped into the corner, and instantly, everyone's eyes lock onto the rubber disc.
Skating aggressively toward the object you are looking at is a deeply ingrained human instinct. It visually feels like you are making an effort. But from a strategic and geometric standpoint, it is the most damaging thing you can possibly do to your team.
Why does the swarm mentality fail so catastrophically on the ice? There's a cascading series of failures. First, when you blindly skate toward the puck, you do not arrive alone.
You inevitably drag the opposing defender who is assigned to mark you right into the pile with you. You have taken a localized battle in the corner that was already crowded, and you have mathematically worsened the odds by importing more defenders.
Second, by closing the distance to zero, you are actively removing yourself as a passing option. As we established, a teammate positioned 15 feet away is a viable geometric option. A teammate positioned 2 feet away, standing inside the exact same checking radius as the puck carrier, is completely useless.
And here is the physical reality of the sport. Pucks do not stay in piles. They bounce. They squirt out of skates, they ricochet off sticks, and they pop out of the chaos into empty ice.
Right. And if you and all your teammates have succumbed to the puck magnet instinct and swarmed into the pile, who is standing in the empty space waiting to retrieve the loose puck when it bounces out?
Yeah.
The opposing team.
You literally vacated the exact geographic coordinates you needed to occupy in order to win the secondary possession.
This realization leads us directly to the most deeply counterintuitive rule in all of hockey spacing. Let's establish a very common scenario. Your teammate is pinned heavily against the boards by a defender. They're engaged in a gritty, physical, exhausting board battle.
Every competitive instinct you possess, everything that feels like working hard, screams at you to skate in there, throw your weight around, and help them dig the puck out.
But the expert mathematical advice is, well, absolutely do not do that. Stay away.
Because if you skate into the pile, you bring your defender, and you physically plug up the only exit route your teammate has.
You must override your instinct to help physically. Your teammate does not need another body crushing him against the glass. What they desperately need is an exit.
They need a designated coordinate to push the puck toward the moment they pry it loose from the opponent's skates.
So the counterintuitive rule for supporting a board battle is move 5 meters away to open ice, put your stick blade flat on the ice to present a target, establish eye contact with your teammate if possible, and mentally become the exit.
The instant your teammate kicks that puck free, you are standing in completely uncontested space, ready to receive it with all the time in the world to make the next play.
There are, however, absolutely critical details and safety interjections here. The rule of staying 5 meters away is not absolute. There are specific exceptions where you must enter the fray.
Right. You do go into the pile if it is a genuine 50-50 scramble where neither team has established any physical control of the puck yet. Or if your coach is running a specific system that demands a designated second player to hit the wall to secure possession.
But, and this cannot be overstated, if the situation demands that you must go into the boards, how you physically arrive is a matter of severe medical safety.
We must emphasize this with absolute clarity. Loose puck races at the boards and diving into existing board battles are the primary vectors for catastrophic spinal injuries in hockey. The rule books across all leagues are entirely unforgiving regarding board safety.
If you're skating toward the boards to retrieve a puck or join a battle, you must never turn your back squarely to the wall, and you must absolutely never duck your head.
The physical mechanics are vital here. You must get your skates parallel to the boards as you arrive. You brace to take any physical contact on your forearm, your hip, and the side of your body. You keep your head up, and you must consciously keep your chin off your chest.
The source material quotes USA Hockey's as safety mandates directly on this specific hazard. They explicitly warn that even a seemingly light, glancing hit from behind can inflict a severe concussion or neck injury if you're facing directly into the boards, because the energy has nowhere to go but into your spine.
And the extreme danger of ducking your head. A collision with the boards while your head is down can result in a broken neck at mere walking speed. It does not require a massive full-speed NHL-level impact.
The biomechanics of the human spine simply cannot handle axial loading, force applied directly downward through the top of the head. So, if you are the second player arriving at a board battle, arrive parallel, maintain a stable, wide base, and fiercely protect the alignment of your spine.
Let's pause, take a breath, and synthesize everything we have covered so far. We have established that we must build a triangle to defeat the single defender.
We defined the Goldilocks distance of 10 to 15 feet using the time test.
We mapped out the required availability of the three angles, behind, level, and ahead. And we learned to fight the psychological urge of the puck magnet by staying 5 meters away from a board battle to serve as the exit.
We have the shape, the size, and the geography. Now, we transition to putting this entire geometric framework into live motion across the three distinct zones of the ice rink.
And motion is the operative concept here, because having perfect spatial positioning on the ice is completely useless if your timing is wrong. This introduces the critical principle of timing over position.
The sources make a brilliantly subtle point here that I want to explore. They state that arriving at the right spot late, but with speed, is vastly superior to arriving at the right spot early and standing still.
To understand why, you have to look at it through the eyes of a defenseman. A player standing completely stationary on the ice, even if they are in the theoretically perfect geometric position, is incredibly easy to defend.
If you sprint to the perfect support spot early and just stop, waiting for the puck carrier to pass it to you, you give the defending player all the time in the world to casually skate over and stand right next to you.
You were geometrically open for a second, but by arriving early and hitting the brakes, you voluntarily converted yourself into a tightly marked player. Furthermore, from a physics standpoint, if you receive a pass while standing completely still, you have to spend your first two strides purely accelerating from zero.
That momentary lack of speed makes you a massive, vulnerable target for an immediate turnover.
I think the most relatable way to visualize this is merging onto a busy highway. Imagine you are driving your car down an on-ramp.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy.
If you drive to the very end of the ramp and hit the brakes, coming to a complete dead stop to wait for a perfect gap in the 70-mile-an-hour traffic, you are dead in the water. You will never get a chance to pull in safely.
You have to visually calculate the flow of traffic and time your acceleration down the ramp so that you arrive at the exact merge point precisely as the gap opens, carrying the exact same velocity as the cars around you.
The highway merge is the perfect mechanical analogy. In hockey, the coaching cue used to teach this timing in the neutral zone is puck first, feet second.
It means you allow the puck carrier to initiate the play and commit an opposing defender toward them, and only then do you aggressively launch your feet into your designated route.
That slight calculated delay ensures that you cross into the open space at top speed precisely while the defender is flat-footed, stuck pivoting and looking at the puck. A late explosive arrival with high velocity entirely destroys a defenseman's ability to set a proper gap.
So, timing your arrival dictates your speed. But what about the physical passing lane itself? The source material draws a very sharp, almost harsh distinction between a player being unmarked and a player actually being available.
Unmarked simply means there is no opponent currently standing within stick reach of you. Available means the geometry dictates that a pass can actually be successfully completed from the carrier's stick to yours.
Unmarked absolutely does not guarantee availability. You might be standing unmarked 30 feet away, but there might be a massive defender standing 10 meters away who just happens to be perfectly aligned directly in the sight line between you and the puck carrier.
You are completely unmarked, but geometrically, you are entirely unavailable.
And whose responsibility is it to fix that broken geometry? This requires a massive mindset shift for a lot of players who think they are doing their job just by finding open ice.
It is entirely the receiver's job to open the passing lane, not the passer's. The passer is busy avoiding getting hit. If the lane between you and the puck is blocked by an opponent's body or stick, you must physically move.
You shift one hard stride to the left or right to fundamentally alter the angle and bypass the obstruction. You present your stick blade flat and hard on the ice to provide a defined physical target. And you aggressively use your voice because the puck carrier's head is often down, fighting through pressure.
You cannot just drift into an empty zone and hope. You must aggressively engineer a clear passing angle.
Now, let's take these concepts of timing and lane creation and systematically apply them to the specific environments of the three zones, beginning in the defensive zone. The foundational geometry required to escape your own end is called the breakout triangle.
Picture the chaotic scramble after an opponent dumps the puck in. Your defenseman skates back and retrieves the puck behind your own net. Before they even think about turning up the ice, they require immediate geometric options.
The standard textbook breakout triangle provides them with three specific targets. First, the strong side winger stationary on the half wall, which serves as the up option. Second, the center, who is swinging low and carrying speed through the middle of the ice, serving as the attacking option.
And third, their defensive partner, trailing slightly on the far side of the net.
And we must recall our strict rule regarding the defensive zone. If the puck carrier uses the defensive partner as an outlet, that pass must travel behind the net, utilizing the physical barrier of the goal structure, never across the exposed slot in front.
But there is a vital zone-specific priority we must emphasize here. When you are operating in your own defensive zone, structural safety dramatically outranks aggressive geometry. The safe, short outlet pass is infinitely more valuable than a risky, stretching, attacking pass. You keep your support distances tight, and you prioritize the safest possible angles.
Why is the structure so rigid in the defensive zone? Because the punishment for geometric failure in your own end is incredibly severe. If your support structure breaks down, if your winger blows the zone early, or your center doesn't swing low, the defenseman has no options.
If they're forced to panic under pressure and ice the puck, firing it all the way down the entire length of the ice, you trigger a massive compounded penalty under NHL and IIHF rules.
We are referring to Rule 81. Icing the puck stops the play immediately, brings the ensuing face-off all the way back deep into your own defensive zone, and completely, legally forbids your team from executing a line change or utilizing a timeout.
The tired, exhausted players who just structurally failed to execute the breakout are legally trapped on the ice against fresh opponents. The governing bodies implemented this rule specifically to punish defensive panic. The only permitted exceptions to this line change prohibition are to replace a genuinely injured player, or if an unrelated penalty alters the numerical on-ice strength.
This forces teams to actually learn to execute spacing under duress. Now, if your team is already shorthanded, meaning you're currently killing a penalty, you are generally granted a structural exemption. You are allowed to ice the puck without triggering a whistle. But the source documents are very careful to point out that this is not a universal, global get-out-of-jail-free card across all leagues.
It is critical to know your specific rulebook. The shorthanded icing exemption varies wildly. In the NHL, if your team is shorthanded specifically because you took a 5-minute major penalty, but the penalized player was ejected, and you have no one sitting in the penalty box to legally release, you actually lose that icing exemption. You cannot ice the puck freely.
Even more drastically, under USA hockey rules, the shorthanded icing exemption has been completely abolished for all youth levels below the 15-only classification.
If you are playing 14U hockey in the United States and your team is killing a penalty and you fire the puck down the ice, the whistle blows, is icing, and the faceoff comes right back to your zone, this forces youth players to learn to break out of their zone via passing, even while shorthanded.
Let's also analyze the goaltender's role in this breakout geometry, because structurally they serve as the fourth option. The goalie actually has the absolute best vantage point on the ice. They're facing forward, surveying the entire rink, and they don't have to look down at a puck.
They can dictate the play and call out the open angles verbally, but when it comes to physically playing the puck to act as a passing node, that gets highly complicated.
Extremely complicated, and entirely dependent on the specific lines painted on your rink. Under NHL and IIHF professional rules, the goaltender's physical participation is heavily restricted by the trapezoid.
They are only permitted to play the puck behind the goal line if they are standing inside the painted trapezoid markings directly behind the net, or if they keep at least one skate in physical contact with their goal crease.
If they stray into the corners to play a puck, they are immediately assessed a 2-minute minor penalty for delay of game. This rule forces defensemen to go into the highly physical, dangerous corners to retrieve dump-ins, because the goalie cannot help them.
But if you are playing amateur hockey under USA Hockey or Hockey Canada regulations, there is no trapezoid painted on the ice.
Exactly. Neither of the primary North American amateur rulebooks utilizes the trapezoid restriction. In those leagues, the goaltender operates as a genuine, mobile, physical fourth option. They can skate deep into the corners to stop rimmed pucks and initiate the breakout pass, which fundamentally alters the defensive zone geometry, allowing the defenseman to stay higher and safer.
However, there is a massive catch to this freedom. While they can play the puck, they are severely restricted from freezing the puck outside their crease.
For example, if a goaltender leaves their crease to play a puck in the corner, panics under pressure, and simply covers the puck with their glove to force a whistle under Hockey Canada rules, it is an automatic non-negotiable 2-minute minor penalty for delay of game. No warning is issued.
Wow, so the literal geometry of your breakout is entirely dictated by which rulebook your specific league uses. You have to know the rules before you rely on your goalie as an outlet.
Okay, moving our geometry up the ice into the neutral zone, the spatial organization shifts dramatically here. It transitions from a tight, interconnected triangle to three distinct vertical lanes running up the ice. Geographically, you divide the neutral zone into the strong side boards lane, the central middle lane, and the weak side boards lane. The standard, universal coaching default in the neutral zone is to spread the attack out. Place exactly one offensive player in each of the three lanes.
This maximizes the physical width of the ice, stretching the opposing defensive structure to its absolute breaking point. Because if two of your offensive players accidentally drift into the exact same vertical lane, we're instantly back to the meat on a skewer problem we discussed earlier. One single defender can cover both of you simultaneously.
The golden rule here is same lane, same checker. That is the universally accepted default spacing. Spread wide.
But there is a fascinating high-level tactical exception to this rule. Some advanced teams run a neutral zone system called a 1-3-1 regroup.
In this specific system, they deliberately violate the rule. They intentionally stack the middle lane with two players, a center swinging very low and another forward supporting high directly above him in the exact same lane.
They intentionally place two players in the same lane to aggressively overload the center seam. They willingly accept that one opposing checker might be able to see both players, because the ultimate goal is to force the opposing defense to panic and collapse inward to protect the overloaded middle.
By pulling the defense inside, they instantly blast open massive acreage in the outside lanes. If you join a new team, you absolutely must ask your coach if the system dictates spreading out or stacking the middle, because the two systems look identical for the first 2 seconds, and then require completely opposite geometric decisions.
Finally, we cross the blue line and enter the offensive zone. The geometry morphs yet again. It is no longer about maintaining static positioning in vertical lanes. The organizing principle becomes constant, fluid rotation.
The physics of the offensive zone dictate this change. A puck passed around the perimeter of the offensive zone travels significantly faster than any human being can possibly skate. Therefore, the geometric goal is no longer about owning a specific square of ice. It is about ensuring that three specific layers of depth are continuously occupied.
The layers are someone stationed below the puck, typically battling behind or directly beside the net. Someone stationed level with the puck, operating on the half wall or lurking in the slot. And someone stationed above the puck, acting as the safety valve at the blue line point.
The critical insight here, the mental leap, is that as a player, you do not own a spot on the ice. You temporarily occupy a layer. Because the puck moves so rapidly, the players must constantly rotate to maintain the structure.
If you are the player at the point, and you see an opportunity to pinch down the wall to keep a puck in, you are abandoning the above layer.
The system only survives if another forward recognizes your movement and instantly rotates high to replace you and refill the vacated layer. The structural layer itself must remain occupied at all times, even as the three individual players constantly swap roles in a continuous cycle.
That continuous cycle brings us beautifully into our final major concept. Everything we have meticulously detailed up to this point has focused on offensive geometry. How to space yourselves when your team controls the puck. But the true brilliance of this entire spatial logic is that it inverts flawlessly when the opponent gains possession.
We are talking about inverting for defense. The critical difference between layering versus converging. Let's establish the golden rule of defensive support.
When we are on the attack, the second arriving player's entire job is to provide the puck carrier with a divergent passing option. When we switch to defense, what is the geometric job of the second arriving player?
The job of the second defensive player is to structurally support the first defender, and crucially, they must absolutely not duplicate the first defender's action.
This requires overriding another massive ingrained human instinct. Let's set the scene. I am the second defender hustling back into our zone. I look up and see my defensive partner intensely pressuring the opponent's puck carrier along the sideboards. Every competitive bone in my body, everything that screams aggressive defense, tells me to sprint over there, jump into the battle, double-team the puck carrier, and aggressively strip the puck away.
And if you surrender to that instinct and execute that double-team, you are mathematically shattering your entire team's defensive structure. Let's break down the cold arithmetic of a double-team.
If you and your defensive partner aggressively converge on one single opposing puck carrier, you have voluntarily committed two defensive assets to one single offensive variable.
Because you are physically converged in the same space, both of you can be instantly beaten and eliminated from the play by one single simple pass out of the pressure.
And the resulting math problem for the rest of the ice behind you is utterly terrifying.
It is geometrically fatal. There are 5 skaters on each team. If 2 of your defenders are now permanently glued to one single opposing puck carrier on the wall, that mathematically dictates that the remaining 3 defenders on your team are now solely responsible for covering the remaining 4 opposing offensive players spread across the rest of the zone.
You have intentionally, voluntarily manufactured a 4-on-3 power play advantage for the opposing team in the middle of a 5-on-5 game. By definition, one opponent has been left completely unguarded. And as the source material bluntly states with zero ambiguity, it is the free man who scores the goals.
So converging on the puck carrier is a geometric disaster. What is the proper structural alternative? How do we apply our spacing rules defensively?
The correct geometric technique is called layering. Instead of skating directly at the puck carrier to double-team them, you position yourself several feet behind and slightly offset diagonally toward the middle of the ice relative to your pressuring teammate. You create a physical layer of depth.
You are intentionally standing in the exact physical space that the puck carrier plans to skate into if they manage to beat your first defender.
I am preemptively covering the mistake before the mistake even happens.
Exactly. You serve two critical functions. First, you physically eliminate the puck carrier's immediate escape route toward the net. Second, by sitting back in the lair, you place your body and your stick directly in the most dangerous passing lane leading out of the pressure toward the slot.
And what is the proper distance for establishing this defensive lair? It all connects back perfectly. It is the exact same Goldilocks zone we established for offensive support, 2 to 3 stick lengths away.
The underlying physics are identical. If you establish your defensive layer too close to your pressuring teammate, a single quick deke or toe drag by the puck carrier can physically bypass both of you simultaneously.
If you establish your layer vastly too far away, the puck carrier beats your first defender and simply accelerates right through the massive gap in the ice before you have the physical time to close on them.
You must position yourself close enough to instantly absorb the attack if the first man is beaten, but far enough away that one single physical move does not eliminate you both.
The sources do mention that there is one specific exception to the strict no converging rule, but it is highly contextual.
Yes, deliberate, coordinated double teams do exist, but they are a strict systemic coaching decision, not a rogue freelance choice you make on the fly because you got excited. Advanced teams will often strategically permit a deliberate double team, specifically when the puck is trapped below their own goal line in the defensive zone.
Why is it permitted there? Because geometrically, a turnover or lost physical battle below the goal line is naturally contained by the physical barrier of the net structure and the end boards. It is a lower risk area to gamble two bodies.
But anywhere else on the 200-foot ice surface, the neutral zone, the offensive zone, the half wall, proper layering is an absolute structural requirement.
This has been an incredibly dense, rewarding journey through the spatial logic of the sport. We are moving into our final synthesis to lock this all in. Let's integrate this entire discussion into a single, cohesive mental framework.
If we step all the way back, the integrated mental model we want you, the listener, to permanently adopt is this. Hockey is fundamentally not a game of fixed dots drawn on a locker room whiteboard. It is a continuous, living game of overlapping, rotating triangles stretching dynamically across 200 feet of ice. It is a high-speed, fluid puzzle of geometry.
If you are going to retain just 4 absolute, non-negotiable essentials from this masterclass, burn these into your memory.
Number 1. Two passing options located at different angles will consistently defeat any level of individual, highlight reel skill. Spacing is the unquestionable engine of possession.
Number 2, if you want to assist a teammate who is heavily pinned in a board battle, the absolute best way to help them is to move away. Retreat 5 meters, keep your stick blade flat on the ice, and serve as the open exit valve.
Number 3, timing supersedes static position. It is vastly structurally superior to arrive at a designated spot late, but carrying a high speed, allowing the play to fully develop, rather than arriving early and converting yourself into a static, easily marked target.
And number 4, when playing defense, never converge on the puck. Utilize diagonal layering behind your teammate. Never voluntarily put 2 bodies on 1 puck carrier, because doing so guarantees a free man in the slot.
Those are the core principles.
Mm-hmm.
But intellectual knowledge is useless if it doesn't change your physical behavior. How do we turn those geometric principles into a permanent, automatic habit on the ice? The source material provides us with the ultimate practical self-check. It is one single question you should be consciously asking yourself every few seconds during a live shift.
The question is simply, where are my 2 options? If you have the puck on your stick, you should be able to instantly visually identify your 2 divergent options. If you cannot spot them, you must immediately move your feet to buy time or safely move the puck to someone who has better geometry.
And if you do not have the puck, the internal question flips. Am I actively serving as one of somebody's 2 options right this exact second?
Another way to phrase it is, if the puck carrier looked up this instant, could they pass it to me cleanly without hitting a defender?
And if the honest geometric answer is no, then you are not supporting the play. You are merely watching the game from ice level. You need to instantly move your feet to find an angle.
And crucially, remember that after every single pass you successfully execute, your job is not over. The player you just passed the puck to instantaneously requires 2 new options of their own. Pass the puck and immediately move to a new geometric angle. That continuous motion is the only way the triangle survives.
I want to leave you with a final provocative thought, something designed to completely alter how you consume the sport moving forward.
The very next time you watch a hockey game, whether you are standing behind the glass at your local community rink or watching a high-stakes professional game on television, I want you to force yourself to do something incredibly unnatural. For one full, continuous shift, I want you to completely stop watching the puck.
It is highly uncomfortable at first, because human biology draws our eyes to the high-contrast object in rapid motion. But the real structural game is constantly happening away from the puck.
Watch the weak side winger standing seemingly alone by the far boards in the neutral zone, actively stretching the ice open. Watch the trailing forward on a fast break rush, deliberately delaying their entry stride to ensure they arrive with maximum speed exactly as the defensive gap opens. Watch what happens physically to a highly skilled, star-studded team when their passing options drop to zero and they are forced to either dump the puck away or suffer a critical turnover.
Force yourself to look past the X's and O's, look past the frantic swarming around the boards, and start seeing the underlying shapes.
Because once you finally see the invisible geometry governing the game, you will never, ever be able to unsee it.